Such impressions as were made upon the form would be transmitted to the thinker by sympathetic vibration. In a perfect case of this kind of clairvoyance, it is almost as though the seer projected a part of his consciousness into the thought form, and used it as a kind of outpost from which observation was possible. He is able to see almost as well as he would if he himself stood in the place of his thought form. The figures at which he is looking will appear to him as of life size and close at hand, and he will find it possible to shift his point of view if he wishes to do so. Everyone who can think at all exercises the power to create thought forms. Thoughts are things, and very puissant things. Everyone of us is generating thought forms unceasingly night and day. Our thoughts, as many might suppose, are not exclusively our own business. Evil thoughts, in fact, reach much further than evil words, and may affect any other persons who already have germs of evil in them. As a master has written, man is continually peopling his current in space with a world of his own, crowded with the offspring of his fancies, desires, impulses and passions. A master has also written of the adept being able to project into and materialize in the visible world the forms that his imagination has constructed out of inert cosmic matter in the invisible world. The adept does not create anything new, but only utilizes and manipulates materials which nature has in store around him, and material which, throughout eternities, has passed through all forms. He has but to choose the one he wants and recall it into objective existence. The difference between an undeveloped and a developed man is that the developed man uses thought power consciously. When such a man can consciously create and direct a thought form, his powers of usefulness obviously very largely increase, for he can use the thought form to work in places which, at the moment, he cannot conveniently visit in his mental body. He can thus watch and guide his thought forms and make them the agents of his will. Perhaps the supreme example of a thought form is that known in the Christian Church as the Angel of the Presence. This is not a member of the kingdom of the angels, but a thought form of the Christ, wearing his likeness and being an extension of the consciousness of the Christ himself. It is by means of the Angel of the Presence that is made the change in the elements known as transubstantiation. A similar phenomenon occurs, though at a less high level, in Masonic lodges where a portrait of the HOATF is used. So fully is this thought form a part of himself that the lodge has the benefit of his presence and his blessing just as though he stood there in physical form. It is possible, by an exertion of will power, instantly to dissipate an artificial elemental, or thought form, just as it is possible on the physical plane to kill a poisonous snake in order that it may do no further harm. Neither course of action, however, would commend itself to an occultist except in very unusual circumstances. In order to make clear the reason of this, some little explanation regarding the elemental essence is necessary. Elemental essence, out of which a thought form is constructed, is, as we have already seen, evolving on its own account, that is, it is learning to vibrate at all possible rates. When therefore, a thought holds it for a time vibrating at a certain rate, it is helped to this extent, so that next time a similar vibration strikes it, it will respond more readily than before. Whether the thought ensouling it is evil or good makes no difference whatever to the essence. All that is required for its development is to be used by thought of some kind. The difference between the good and the evil in the would be shown by the quality of essence which was affected, an evil thought or desire needing for its expression the coarser matter, a higher thought or desire requiring finer matter. Thus by degrees mental elemental essence is being evolved, through the action on it of the thoughts of men, nature spirits, devas, and even animals so far as they do think. For this reason, therefore, that is, lest he should in any way impede its evolution, the occultist avoids when possible the destruction of an artificial elemental, preferring rather to defend himself or others against it by using the protection of a shell. The student should not, of course, imagine it is his duty to think coarse thoughts in order to help the evolution of the coarser types of essence. There are plenty of undeveloped people always thinking the coarser, lower thoughts. The occultist should strive ever to think high and pure thoughts and thus aid the evolution of the finer elemental matter, thus working in a field where there are as yet few laborers. Before leaving this subject of thought forms, we should note that every sound makes its impression upon astral and mental matter, not only what we call musical sounds, but every kind of sound. Some of these were described in the astral body, chapter 7. The thought form edifice built up on the higher planes during the celebration of the Christian Eucharist differs somewhat from ordinary thought forms, though it has much in common with forms created by music. It consists of a higher plane structure composed of the materials provided by the priest and his congregation during the earlier part of the service at the etheric, astral and mental levels, matter of still higher levels being introduced in the later portion of the service, chiefly from the angelic host. The thought edifice may be compared to the condenser in a plant for the distillation of water. The steam is cooled and condensed into water in the cooling chamber. Similarly, the Eucharistic edifice provides a vehicle for the collection and condensation of the materials provided by the worshippers, into which an especial outpouring of the divine force from the very highest levels may descend, and which may enable the angel helpers to use that force for certain definite purposes in the physical world. The ceremonies of all great religions aim at producing such results by some sort of common action. The ceremonies of Freemasonry attain a similar object, though in a different way. The thought form built up by a Masonic ceremony is the real celestial canopy, which may also be regarded as the aura of a man lying on his back. This symbolism appears elsewhere as, for example, in Joseph's coat of many colors, in the robe of glory which the initiate puts on, and also in the Orgiades, cp. 237, of the Greek philosophers, the glorified body in which the soul of man dwells in the subtle invisible world. Chapter 9. The mechanism of thought transference. Before proceeding to consider the phenomenon of thought transference and its effects on men, it will be convenient first to describe the mechanism by means of which thought is transmitted from one person to another. The term telepathy means literally feeling at a distance, and might, therefore, have been appropriately confined to the transmission of feelings and emotions. It is, however, now generally used almost synonymously with thought transference, and may be taken to cover any transfer of an image, thought or feeling from one person to another by non-physical means. There are three possibilities in telepathy. There may be direct communication between 1. Two etheric brains, 2. Two astral bodies, 3. Two mental bodies. In the first method, which we may call the physical or etheric method, a thought causes vibrations first in the mental body, then in the astral body, then in the etheric brain, and finally in the dense molecules of the physical brain. By the brain vibrations, the physical ether is affected and the waves pass outwards till they reach another brain, where they set up vibrations in its etheric and dense particles. These vibrations in the receiving brain are then transmitted to the astral and mental bodies attached to it, and so reach the consciousness. If a person thinks strongly of a concrete form in the physical brain, he makes the form in etheric matter. In the effort of making the image, he also sends out etheric waves in every direction. It is not the image itself which is sent out, but a set of vibrations which will reproduce the image. The process is somewhat analogous to the telephone, where the voice itself is not conveyed, but a number of electrical vibrations are set up by the voice, which when they enter the receiver, are converted once more into the sounds of the voice. The pineal gland is the organ of thought transference, just as the eye is the organ of vision. The pineal gland in most people is rudimentary, but it is evolving, not retrograding, and it is possible to quicken its evolution so that it can perform its proper function, the function which, in the future, it will discharge in all. If anyone thinks very intently on a single idea, with concentration and sustained attention, he will become conscious of a slight quiver or creeping feeling. It has been compared to the creeping of an ant in the pineal gland. The quiver takes place in the ether which permeates the gland and causes a slight magnetic current which gives rise to the creeping feeling in the dense molecules of the gland. If the thought be strong enough to cause the current, then the thinker knows that he has been successful in bringing his thought to a pointedness and a strength which render it capable of being transmitted. The vibration in the ether of the pineal gland sets up waves in the surrounding ether like waves of light, only much smaller and more rapid. These vibrations pass out in all directions, setting the ether in motion, and these etheric waves in turn produce vibrations in the ether of the pineal gland in another brain, and from that are transmitted to the astral and mental bodies in regular succession, as previously described, thus reaching consciousness. If the second pineal gland cannot reproduce the undulations, then the thought will pass unnoticed, making no impression, any more than waves of light make an impression on the eye of a blind man. In the second, or astral method of thought transference, the etheric brain does not enter into the process at all, the communication being direct from one astral body to another. In the third, or mental method, the thinker, having created a thought on the mental plane, does not send it down to the brain but directs it immediately to the mental body of another thinker. The power to do this deliberately implies a far higher mental evolution than does the physical method of thought transference, for the sender must be self-conscious on the mental plane in order to exercise knowingly this activity. When mankind is more evolved, this will probably be the common method of communication. It is already employed by the masters in the instruction of their pupils, and in this way they can convey with ease the most complicated ideas. Chapter 10 Thought Transference, Unconscious. In chapters 7 and 8 we have dealt with the generation of thought waves and thought forms, and, to some extent, with the effect of these on others. The latter aspect of our subject is sufficiently important to necessitate further elaboration. We will deal first with that kind of thought transference which is either wholly or partially unconscious. From what has already been said, it is clear that every man, wherever he goes, leaves behind him a trail of thoughts. As we walk along the street, for example, we are walking all the time amidst a sea of other men's thoughts. The whole atmosphere is filled with them, vague and indeterminate. If a man leaves his mind a blank for a time, these residual thoughts, generated by other people, drift through it, making in most cases but little impression upon it but occasionally seriously affecting it. Sometimes one arrives which attracts the man's attention so that his mind seizes upon it and makes it his own for a moment or two, strengthens it by the addition of its force, and then casts it out again to affect someone else. A man, therefore, is not responsible for a thought which floats into his mind, because it may not be his own, but someone else's. He is responsible, however, if he takes it up, dwells upon it, and then sends it out strengthened. Such a mixture of thoughts from many sources has no definite coherence, though any one of them may start a line of associated ideas and so set the mind thinking on its own account. Many men, if they were to examine the stream of thoughts which pass through their minds, would probably be surprised to discover how many idle and useless fancies enter and leave their minds in a short period of time. Not one-fourth of these are their own thoughts. In most cases they are quite useless and their general tendency is more likely to be evil than good. Thus men continually affect each other by their thoughts, sent out mostly without definite intent. Public opinion, in fact, is largely created in this way. For the most part, public opinion is thought transference. Most people think along certain lines not because they have carefully thought questions out for themselves, but because large numbers of others are thinking along those lines and carry others with them. The strong thought of a powerful thinker goes out into the mental world and is caught up by receptive and responsive minds. They reproduce his vibrations, strengthen the thought, and thus help to affect others, the thoughts becoming stronger and stronger and eventually influencing large numbers of people. If we consider these thought forms in the mass, it is easy to realize the tremendous effect they have in producing national and race feeling, and thus in biasing and prejudicing the mind. We all grow up surrounded by an atmosphere crowded with thought forms embodying certain ideas, national prejudices, national ways of looking at things, national types of thoughts and feelings. All these play upon us from our birth, and even before. Everything is seen through this atmosphere, every thought is more or less refracted by it, and our own mental and astral bodies are vibrating in accord with it. Nearly everyone is dominated by the national atmosphere. Public opinion, once formed, sways the minds of the great majority, beating unceasingly upon the brains and awakening in them responsive vibrations. Sleeping and waking, these influences play upon us, and our very unconsciousness makes them more effective. Most people being receptive rather than initiative in their nature, they act almost as automatic reproducers of a thought which reach them, and thus the national atmosphere is continually intensified. An inevitable result of this state of affairs is that nations receiving impressions from other nations modify them by their own vibration rates. Hence people of different nations, seeing the same facts, add to them their own existing prepossessions and quite honestly accuse each other of falsifying the facts and practicing unfair methods. If this truth, and its inevitability, were recognized, many international quarrels would be smoothed more easily than now is the case, and many wars even would be avoided. Then each nation would recognize the personal equation, and instead of blaming the other for difference of opinion, would seek the mean between the two views, neither insisting wholly on its own. Most men never make any effort at real discrimination on their own account, being unable to shake themselves free from the influence of the great crowd of thought forms which constitute public opinion. Hence they never really see the truth at all, nor even know of its existence, being satisfied to accept instead this gigantic thought form. For the occultist, however, the first necessity is to attain a clear and unprejudiced view of everything, to see it as it really is, and not as a number of people suppose it to be. To secure this clearness of vision, unceasing vigilance is necessary. To detect the influence of the great hovering thought cloud is not the same as the ability to defy its influence. Its pressure is ever present, and quite unconsciously we may find ourselves yielding to it in all sorts of minor matters, even though we keep ourselves clear from it with regard to the greater points. We were born under its pressure just as we were born under the pressure of the atmosphere, and are just as unconscious of one as of the other. The occultist imperatively must learn to free himself entirely from this influence, and to face the truth as it is, and not distorted through the medium of these gigantic, collective thought forms. The influence of aggregated thoughts is not confined to that which they exercise on man's subtler vehicles. Thought forms of a destructive type act as a disruptive energy and may often work havoc on the physical plane. They are the fruitful sources of accidents, of natural convulsions, storms, cyclones, hurricanes, earthquakes, floods, etc. They may stir up wars, revolutions, and social disturbances and upheavals of every kind. Epidemics of disease and crime, cycles of accidents, have a similar explanation. Thought forms of anger aid in the perpetration of murder. Thus in every direction, in endless fashions, do men's evil thoughts play havoc, reacting on themselves and others. Turning now to the effects produced, more specifically by thoughts of individuals, the student will recollect that in the astral body we described the effects produced upon a man's astral body by, egg, a rush of devotional feeling. Such devotional feeling is usually accompanied also by thoughts of devotion, draw around themselves a large amount of astral matter as well, so that they act in both mental and astral worlds. A developed man, therefore, is a center of devotional waves, which must inevitably influence other people born both in their thoughts and their feelings. The same, of course, is true in the case of affection, anger, depression, and all other feelings. Another typical example is that of the currents of thought flowing out from a lecturer, and other currents of comprehension and appreciation rising from the audience and joining with those from the speaker. Often it happens that the play of the lecturer's thoughts awakens sympathetic response in the mental bodies of the audience, so that at the time they are able to understand the speaker. Later, however, when the stimulus of the speaker is no longer present, they forget and find they are no longer able to comprehend what at the time seemed clear to them. Critical thought, on the other hand, sets up a page opposing rate of vibration, breaking up the stream and throwing it into confusion. It is said that anyone who has seen this effect produced is little likely to forget the object lesson. In reading a book, a man's thoughts may attract the attention of the writer of the book, who may be in his astral body, during sleep or after physical death. The writer may thus be drawn to the student, thus causing him to be enveloped in the atmosphere of the writer quite as potently as though he were physically present. Similarly, also the thought of the student may attract to himself the thoughts of other persons who have studied the same subject. An excellent example of the effect on the living of the thoughts of a disembodied man occurs where a man has been executed, say, for murder, and where he takes his revenge by instigating other murders. This is, in fact, one explanation of those cycles of murders of the same type which from time to time occur in communities. The effect of thoughts on children is especially marked. Just as a child's physical body is plastic and easily molded, so are his astral body and mental body. A child's mental body drinks in thoughts of others as a sponge draws up water, and though it may be too young to reproduce them now, the seed will bear fruit in due season. Hence the immense importance of a child being surrounded with a noble and unselfish atmosphere. To a clairvoyant it is a terrible sight to see beautiful white child souls and child auras in a few years become soiled, smirched and darkened by the selfish, impure and unholy thoughts of the adults around them. Only the clairvoyant knows how enormously and how rapidly child characters would improve if only adult characters were better. Whilst it is never right to endeavor to dominate the thought and will of another, even though it may be for what seems to be a good end, it is nevertheless always right to fix the thoughts upon man's good qualities, thus tending to strengthen the good characteristics. Conversely, to dwell in thought upon a man's defects or bad qualities is to strengthen the undesirable tendencies or even to produce evil qualities where these previously did not exist, or were merely latent germs. Thus, to take a simple example, suppose that a group of people who indulge in gossip and scandal accuse another of jealousy. If the victim has already a tendency towards jealousy, it is obvious that it will be greatly intensified by such a cataract of thought, whilst even if he is entirely free from jealousy, those who think and talk about his imagined fault are doing their best to create in the man the very vice over the imagined presence of which they gloat so cruelly. The injury done by gossip and scandal is almost immeasurable, and the student will recollect the strong indictment launched against these evil practices in at the feet of the master. The form which the criticism of a true occultist will take will be that happy kind which grasps at a pearl as eagerly as much of our modern criticism pounces upon a flaw. Thus the possibility, or rather the inevitability, of being able to affect others for good or for ill by thought power places a tremendous instrument in the hands of all who choose to wield it. Astromental images, that is, thought forms with which emotion of feeling is also associated, play no inconsiderable part in making karmic links with other people. Thus suppose, to take an extreme example, a man by sending out a thought of bitter hatred and revenge has helped to form in another the impulse which results in murder. The creator of that thought is necessarily linked by his karma to the committer of the crime, even though he has never seen him on the physical plane. Ignorance, or the absence of memory, does not cause a failure in the working of karmic law, and a man must therefore reap the results of his thoughts and feelings as well as of his physical actions. In general, the mental images which a man makes largely influence his future environment. In such fashion are made the ties which draw people together for good or evil in later lives, which surround us with relations, friends and enemies, which bring across our path helpers and hinderers, people who love us without our earning that love in this life, and who hate us, though in this life we have done nothing to deserve that hatred. Hence our thoughts, by their direct action on ourselves, not only produce our mental and moral character, but they also, by their effects on others, help to determine our human associates in the future. It is, of course, possible to protect oneself to a great extent from the incursion of thought forms from outside, by making a wall round oneself of the substance of the aura. Mental matter, as we have seen, responds very readily to the impulse of thought and may easily be molded into any shape we will. The same things can be done with astral matter, as we saw in the astral body. Nevertheless, to use a shell for oneself is to a certain extent a confession of weakness, the best protection of all being a radiant goodwill and purity which will sweep away everything undesirable in a mighty outpouring stream of love. the occasions on which it may be necessary to make use of a shell for oneself are: 1. When entering a promiscuous crowd, 2. In meditation, 3. When sleep is approaching, 4. Under special conditions where without its help lower thoughts would be likely to obtrude themselves. 2. Will be dealt with in chapter 16, 3. In chapter 18, 4. In chapter 13. A shell has distinct uses when helping other people, and an invisible helper will frequently find it invaluable in helping a man who has not yet the strength to protect himself, either against the ever-present swirl of wearisome and wandering thoughts. There seems no doubt that animals who live in a world of emotion possess a telepathic faculty of sending emotional impulses to others of their kind at a distance. In fact, William J. Long, in his fascinating book How Animals Talk, states that he has reason to believe that this method of silent communication is the common language of the whole animal kingdom. Numerous examples are given by this keen and sympathetic observer of animal life. A setter named Don appeared always to know when his master was returning home, even at unusual and unexpected times. He knew also when Saturday or holidays came, and when his master intended to take him out into the woods. Another dog named Watch was repeatedly observed to set out to meet his master at times which constantly varied, within a few moments of the time when his master started for home from a place some 3 or 4 miles away, driving a trap drawn by a horse between whom and the dog there was a strong friendship. The way in which fear or nervousness is readily communicated from a rider to his horse is well known to every horseman. If a wolf cub breaks away from the pack, the mother wolf, instead of chasing the cub, has been observed to remain quiet, lift her head and look steadily in the direction of the cub, whereupon the latter will waver, halt, and speed back to the pack. A vixen appears to have her family under perfect control at every instant without uttering a sound. One steady look at them, and the cubs instantly cease their play, scamper into the burrow, and remain there until mother returns from her hunting. A wounded wolf, after lying up by itself for a few days, has been known to go straight to the carcass of an animal, 8 or 10 miles, which the pack had killed in the meantime, there being, of course, no trail to follow. A Captain Rule has observed that the moment he struck a sperm whale, every other sperm whale within 10 miles would turn flukes as if he also had been harpooned. Certain wild birds will make their appearance in the backyard at a moment when a number of other birds are eagerly feeding, and at no other time. The wing drill of starlings is a phenomenon which appears explicable only by the telepathic hypothesis. A similar remark applies to the movements of flocks of plovers. Many huntsmen have observed that if they go out without a gun or any intention to kill, they frequently see and approach very near to wild animals in plenty, but when they go out armed, and with a desire to kill, they find the animals restless, suspicious, and unapproachable. One hunter, who has learned that excitement is transmissible from man to animals, suppressed his own physical and mental excitement, and found that he could then approach his quarry much more easily than he had been able to do before he had learned his lesson, the truth of this being proved by the tiger skins he had obtained. Our author goes further, and states that he has met many Indians and others possessed of what certain Africans call champfo, which acts as though it were a distinct sense, giving warning of approaching danger, etc., often in circumstances which preclude the possibility of any information reaching any of the 5 normal senses. Readers who are interested in this subject in particular and animal life in general, are strongly advised to read How Animals Talk, and other books by William J. Long. Chapter 11 Thought, Transference, Conscious, and Mental Healing. It is within the power of almost any 2 persons, provided they care to devote to the effort sufficient time and perseverance, and are capable of clear and steady thought, to convince themselves of the possibility of thought transference, and even to become moderately proficient in the art. There is, of course, quite a considerable literature on the subject, such as the Transaction of the Psychical Research Society. The 2 experiments should agree on a time mutually convenient, devoting, say, 10 or 15 minutes daily to the task. Each should then secure himself from interruption of any kind. One should be the thought projector or transmitter, and the other the receiver, In most cases, it is desirable to alternate these roles in order to avoid the risk of one becoming abnormally passive. Moreover, it may be found that one is much better at transmitting, the other at receiving.